Welcome to the Road to Recovery group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Lawrence and I'm an alcoholic. And now to our fourth and final speaker, who's come all the way from Scotland to see us. Del, please.
Hi, thanks, Lawrence. My name is Del, from the Capital Universe here in Glasgow, Scotland. Great to see a happy smiling face, Lawrence. Thanks, Wayne, for the invite, and it's good to see you all here in Plymouth. I was down some years ago and I had a fantastic experience, so hopefully you can tolerate my Scottish accent. I'm not going to swear this evening. I'm going to be on my best behaviour. Thanks to the previous speakers for telling me how they are today. It's great and wonderful to listen to Real Recovery. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the 5th of April 1987, and I'm a serving member of the Emotional Sobriety Group Sunday afternoon here in Glasgow. And it's just a joy to come along and talk about my favourite subject, which is me, you know. I'm just going to go for it. I might say things, share things. You might tune into, you might not tune in, you might switch off, you might go away, you might cuss, you might swear, and then complain to Wayne or Lawrence, but why did you get this guy on the deal? Because, you know, he was completely mad, you know. But that's one of the things that I recognise, that this madness, this insanity of alcoholism got me before I even drank. I seen what alcoholism did to my mother, who died at 40. I seen how it impacted my dad at 42, and I was an orphan kid, you know, and I was lost. I just couldn't quite get to understand it, and, you know, and became, you know, kind of, you know, withdrawn in life. And in order to deal with that sort of, you know, isolation, took up sport, which was boxing. And I loved boxing. I loved amateur and I trained professional. And I thought this is what I was going to be as a 15-year-old kid. There's going to be the next John H. Tracy, the next Ken Buchanan. And I had, you know, had grandiose ideas that one day someday I'll be somebody, because then it was a nobody. I seen what alcoholism did to my mother. I seen I had a different dad every 6 months. I seen how it affected my dad as well. There was can, there was upset, there was violence, there was dysfunction, disorder, and there was a lot of trauma. So from the ages of zero, when I came out of the room, to the ages of 15, no one told me that they loved me, liked me, wanted me. I just had to learn all that goofy, cranky stuff later on in sobriety. And, you know, I'm trying to make my way in the world, and I'm doing okay in sport, but I'm hopeless at school. My mind's elsewhere, because I had this conviction and this ambition that I was going to make the grade big time. And then, lo and behold, would you believe it, I discovered booze when I was about 16 years of age, and something seemed to happen to my brain set, my mindset, and my ambitions. And now I'm 5'10", and then I was, you know, skinny malinky. I was a flyweight, bantamweight. I won a couple of wee titles, and I walked into a pub in the bar one day, and I took this sherry, and I took this drink, and suddenly, whoa, down my mouth and my throat, and I just felt like Giganto. I just felt like Rambo the second, you know. I just felt this kind of, wow, this buzz, my brain seemed to kick in, everything seemed to go technicolor, and I thought, this is the part of the missing jigsaw. And that began a journey for me of great adventure and great great insanity, because all the ambitions to be somebody in sport and whatever, just over a period of 6 months, a year, just went absolutely. I put weight on, and I started to be a bit kind of naughty. I started to get a wee bit cheeky. I developed a Jekyll and Hyde character. Something seemed to happen to me. My sister became a legal guardian. And she was 21, I'm 16, 17. And long story short, I became addicted to the excitement. I became addicted to that experience, that euphoric recall. I became caught up in the buzz, the excitement. I love pubs. I love casinos. I love the characters. I love the shady bars, the shady places. You know, I love to go at the East End of Glasgow when the Celtic and Rangers game was on. And depending on my mood, I'd be a Rangers supporter when I'm a Celtic supporter. And then I'd be a Celtic supporter when, in fact, I'd be a Rangers supporter. I was a chameleon. Where I went where the buzz was, the excitement was. And I just joined in the insanity, the fist fights, the you know, the one night stands, the whole excitement and drama of it all, and thinking this is all right, this is okay. But it wasn't all right, and it wasn't okay. I just sensed, I woke up the next day, checking my face, checking my knuckles, checking my body, checking my pockets, just making sure, right, I've still got arms and legs and a face, you know, and checking other things so that I had money in my pocket to go and start again. And despite the trouble, despite the wrong foot, and despite the money lenders, despite the sort of, you know, the controversy, the drama, I just knew something wasn't right within me. My sister used to say to me, "You're mad." I said, "Yeah, you're damn right I am." And here I am, 18, 19, 20, thinking this is all right, getting in with the crowd, getting in with the tribe, and causing mayhem within my own family and elsewhere, working in a steelworks by this time, and working in with these heavy, hard drinkers in the steelworks in Glasgow. And, you know, you attract what you lack. And I just, I lacked that, you know, sensibility. I just didn't quite get it. I had to prove myself as a man. I had to grow up very quick and fast. And I got myself into a lot of dangerous situations because I thought, well, that was tough. You know something, a few whiskies, a few vodkas, a bit of the old Buckfast, you know, the White Tornado, and I'm rocking. And there's the blackouts, and there's the trouble, and it all just happened. And lo and behold, it caught up with me. And I moved from place to place to eventually, despite trouble, my mother's sister, who was a raging codependent, who was a raging fixer, met up with me and said, "Look, we're concerned about you. We're hearing a lot of stories. Why do you come stay with me, and we'll look out for you?" And that began a different journey for me, despite my best efforts. I got disciplined at work. I mean, come on, I could give you a drunk log and a drinking story, it'll impress you. But I'm not here to tell you that I had to qualify for this fellowship. And so in my first experiences with AA, 23 years of age, with a waistline to match, and I came into fellowship and they told me to stay away for one drink one day at a time. I had a lot of ball, a lot of trouble. I was introduced to this guy. He said, "Look, come along here, we'll look after you, and take it a day at a time, got to adjust with the day card, do plenty of meetings." But my mind was elsewhere. My mind was looking out for, I'm looking for the sort of the get out clause, you with me? I'm looking for, right, okay, I've made a wrong move here. Yeah, I owed some money and things weren't doing so good. I lost my job. Right, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll become a born-again Christian. So I became a born-again Christian at 24 years of age, thereabouts, on the Wednesday. And I was a drunk born-again Christian on the Friday. I just couldn't understand the nature of alcoholism. I just couldn't understand the nature of insanity. In fact, I got a wee bit of AA literature, and I got the 24-hour book on one occasion, and I used to take this 24-hour book into the pubs and read it to people and say, "By the way, what do you think?" "Well, I'm sipping my whiskey." And they're like, "Ah, very good, mate. Off you go, yabam," and more. And that was a comfort. I just generally thought I'd lose my mind, lose my way, got into a few kind of scary situations. And then I just thought, "Oh, you know something, I need to do something here." I had a lucid interval at 26 years of age. I came back to AA and I was once again the same old story. I just thought, "Man, I can't go on like this. Homeless, helpless, hopeless." I've got this working vocabulary now, but I didn't have it then. And I just came to. I just went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous after phoning Samaritans, because my best thinking brought me to the jumping off place at the Glasgow Argyle Street subway station. I thought, I can just fall into this train. The fight within the guy used to walk into pubs and clubs in certain places and thought the party can begin now, you know. And lo and behold, here I am thinking, I think I better just take this away now, just go, because I'm causing too much pain, too much shame. And here I'm, I phoned up Samaritans, they said, "God, why don't you go to meet a VA?" And I came back, and that was April the 5th, 1987. Walked into this hall, got a half cup of tea, and I met a guy called Coleman Joe. He showed me the compassion, he showed me the love, he gave me the dignity that I'd lost. And he said, "You'd like to go for a fish tea?" And he took me for a fish tea. This big guy, 6'4", big leather jacket, really scars all over his face, and broken nose, cauliflower ear. And he showed me a love, and he showed me that tolerance. He says, "You need never drink again, Del, you'll be okay." He gave me my bus fare, says, "The meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight in your town, go there." and let me know how you got on. I'll see you in the road. And that began my journey. And I began to qualify for AA, the third edition, No One Desire to Stop Drinking. Is a desire to stop drinking. And then I began that kind of experience where, okay, I did meetings, joined a group, and I met somebody who seemed to have a clue, an idea how this works. And at 26 years of age, I just got into it, and I began to feel better about myself. I was, you know, waking up, and I was working in the doors in Glasgow at the time, so I was a bit wary about that, but I did that just to earn a wee bit extra money. And then that became a bit of a kind of mind if, you with me? And I just thought, no, I just can't do this. And eventually I met this guy, took me through the program recovery, and I got it. And, you know, from the doors to security guard, and then I worked with a company insurance, became a salesman insurance. And then I met Agnes, my wife of today, 32 years, and she couldn't resist my company of red eyes, high cheekbones, a bubbly personality. And we got together, and we met in night school, and we fell in lust, as you do. And that's how alcoholics do it. We fall in lust, then we figure it out afterwards, you know, and then we fell in love, or kind of. And I met this lovely Irish girl who, you know, dropped dead. And that's when I began to realise, I've got a problem here. I don't know how to emote. I don't know how to relate. I'm very withdrawn. After the bedroom, after hello, how you doing, I'm kind of limited. I'm into Sky Sports. I'm into beans and toast. I'm not into big conversation. And I'm into feelings, though. I'm into feeling resentment. I'm into feeling fear. Who's that guy you're talking to last night? Who is that? Well, tell me about your story. And jealousy, suspicion, paranoia, that kind of thing. You know, the kind of holy trinity. And I had a crash and burn experience. We got married, got kids and different things. I'm racing on here because I rested my laurels after a few years of sobriety. I rested my laurels. I just kind of thought, I'm okay here. I'm working in banking here. I've turned my life around. A wee bit of respectability, a wee bit of dignity. And then I kind of got involved in the outside issues, you with me? I just kind of, things weren't going so good in the bedroom. Things weren't going so good in my job. I began to get a wee bit, resentful and pissed off at life and living. And I ended up kind of getting caught up in my own self again. You see, I'm addicted to me. I'm addicted to resentments, those bitches and bastards that screwed me over. I'm addicted to self-centered fear. I'm a control junkie extraordinaire, gold standard. I've got a double life. Do you know who I am? You're that guy who kind of handles his drink. You're an AA, mate. You've got to own up and show up. Oh, man, here we go. I had a crash and burn. Did something I shouldn't have done and crossed the line in certain areas. I had to go and seek help. And I found myself going to America, meet some dudes over there. And Texas, and they kind of, this was in the early millennium, and they got my attention. I met some guys called Chris R. and Mark Myers and Mark Houston, all these kind of nice people. And I met a guy called Cliff Bishop who kind of sat me down and says, are you a real alcoholic? That's a cheek. I said, I need to qualify you. And we went to the spirit of the book, and I got that. I recognize now that I had to deal with this condition called alcoholism. I had to realise that I was suffering from this malady of self. Now, I know there might be 12-step theologians here. I know there might be guys who might have a different view, a different position. Please be offended if you are and talk to your sponsor because, you know, this is just my experience. I just know and knew that I had to change my position. I just knew that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it thrives on resentment. It thrives on this idea that one day, someday, I can control and manage my resentments. I can control and manage my self-centered fears. I can control and manage my self-will and my self-reliance and be that state character. And I had to get really down to causes and conditions because I found that resentment is just a symptom. Self-centered fear is just a symptom. The real problem is my selfishness. It's all about me, my self-seeking. It's still what's in it for me. And you know, that selfish resentment, that self-centered fear, that self-seeking relationship, you know what I'm talking about? So I had a conversation with Cliff and went through the spirit of the book and I found out that I'm powerless. Powerless means that I cannot manage the most earned decision not to drink. And more in emotional sobriety, I can't even handle that, you know, resentment that I was so immune to. I mean, people can resent and, you know, say things, do things in a way that, with impunity, that I couldn't. I mean, I did have a temper. I'm a recovering radioholic in the sense that I just kind of kicked off if somebody didn't go quick enough at the traffic lights. And so I found out step one is a big deal. Step two is a step two proposition. I'm now willing to trust this God that I didn't quite believe in. Step two is that insanity of me. And step three was I said, okay, now I'm going to get better, not bitter. And I looked at pages 60 to 62, where I looked at the malady, the spiritual malady they talk about and writes about the book. That's where it said that affliction to me and what am I going to do in my little plans and designs when I was an emotional present for my wife, where I was an emotional present for my son, my daughter. Really, it was all about getting money, making money and being the great I am. And then writing down my resentments, my 172 resentments, I may add, because I was pretty pissed off because I didn't get my own way. And I looked at all my fears, my neurosis, my paranoia, my suspicions, my jealousies. And I looked at my sex conduct, you know, how to be lusted, what is be lusted after, no romantic intrigue, you know what I mean? You know, the kind of visual stuff, I look at that. And, you know, that kind of double life, you know, how I medicated myself, you know, away from the bedroom. How I love that kind of, you know, that kind of will I want, you know, in the office. And that's been a challenge to me on an ongoing basis where I've had to sort of seek counsel and guidance elsewhere because I like, I guess, I don't know about you guys, I like that attention. I like that validation. I like that sort of, you know, that drugstore and the mind experience, that euphoria, you know, that somebody thinks I'm something. You know, I mean, look at me, I'm grey hair, I'm overweight, I'm doing something, come on. But in my mindset, I think I'm George Clooney. I think I'm, you know, I've got that kind of, you know, a creative imagination. But it's a creative imagination that will take me to drunkenness. Not only alcoholism, but that sexual, emotional and relational drunkenness, where it's all about that addiction to my own ease and comfort. So I had a good conversation with Cliff about extreme self-will run riot. I shared how I like to run the show, how I like to be Jackie Ladd, how I like to get that validation affirmation. And I told the truth about my secrets, you know, the secrets, the sexual, emotional, criminal, the financial. And I opened up to somebody because trust was a huge deal for me. A huge deal for me. If I didn't trust you, I didn't like you. If I didn't like you, then you didn't get a vote. And I lacked a sense of humour then because I was so inward. And Cliff heard my story. And he says, welcome to the 100 Club. He qualified me. He says, you're one of us. Welcome to the 100 Club. And I looked at my fifth step, my 172 resentments, my fears and my double life. And there was a lot of them. There was a lot of them in my mind and literally and practically in that. And in step six and seven, you know, through the bit of alcohol, it's enormous. There's a treatment plan is telling me, now you can get better. Because the first steps are diagnostic. The first step is about, I've got a problem here. Step two is about, say, we've found a solution here. Step three, I said, do you want to get better here? And step four says, well, let's look at what are the spiritual barriers that prevent you getting to know that God better, because you ain't it. You're not God, although I thought I was in the lives of certain people, and I wasn't. I lacked humility. I lacked that candor. I was a kind of, you know, I wanted to impress people with my knowledge and my sense of humor, and I realized, no, that's just all part of stage character. And step six and seven, I was now willing just to get a bit better. And I said, right, okay, I'm just going to continue the rest of the program recovery. Again, in the discipline of doing AA in the spirit of the book. And I made amends and restitution. I had a list of people that had affected, offended, and upset. Not only through, I did this before, incidentally. I did the clean up the drunken wreckage of the past. But here I am, I had a crash and burn experience sober. And I'm not drinking, but I'm emotionally drunk. And I had to go back to certain people and say, by the way, you know, can I have a conversation with you? I need to get this right with you. I'll never get well. I'll never go over drinking until I get my story straight, they say. And I got one or two people who weren't all that impressed. They told me where to go. I said, I'm sorry you feel that way, but there you go. And that includes my wife. That includes my kids. That includes certain members of my family, certain people in AA and elsewhere, where I was a bit kind of, let me say, you know, out of sorts. And step nine was about putting that amends and restitution into place and get my story straight, developing boundaries, developing that kind of discipline. And step 10 was all about, you know, me looking for those defects. You know, the biggest one being my extreme self. Well, what's in it for me? My little plans and designs. And through time, through process, I got involved in a group, a big book study group. Through time, I began to educate myself about spirituality. Through time, I began to take a real interest in the big book. I connected to men and women who understood how it works and why it works, and there was no hidden agendas. There's been some challenges in my experiences, trust me, there has. I've got those vulnerabilities and weaknesses, but you know something? To learn about just detaching and not getting involved in insanity of other people's insanity. And step 10 was, I'm watching for that resentment. Step 10 is about, I'm watching for that self-centered fear. And step 10 is saying to me, right, you don't need to run the show here and don't overreact. We avoid retaliation and argument. You know, if I'm offended, it's page 6 or 7. If I offend, which I'm quite capable of doing still, then it's a page 84. I'm sorry I upset you there. I'm just, you know, I'm a bit out of sync here. And step 11 is about this power of greater myself. Step 11 is about me getting my story straight all the time, every time, and being on standby. It's no longer about Dale. It's all about what can I do for this higher power, this God, that I still sometimes don't understand. But what I do know, it works. And because I've woken up to that reality, I've woken up to the fact that the obsession for alcoholism is gone, and the obsession for Derek is also gone too. But I've only got a reprieve. I've only got a deal that's subject to my spiritual condition. And what is that? Working with others, my primary purpose. Staying sober in the spirit of the daily disciplines of looking at myself, not you. I'm tempted to look at you because I'm a blame and a shame. I like to think, well, I'm looking at this guy and this dude and thinking, well, look at that. And I thought, don't even go there. Just don't go there. Because it's, you know, it's my mind, it's my focus. And step 11 is about prayer, asking for guidance and reflection, meditation. Just waiting for that response. I'm not looking to become a spiritual giant, not looking to become a recovery star, not looking to become anything, just trying to remain a bit humble, a bit more humoured, a bit more, you know, kind of honest about who I am, where I am, when I'm working with others. And step 12 is about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, not long talks, not meetings, not self-help books such as The Four Agreements or The Power of Now. It's about, you know, having had a spiritual win as a result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to the still suffering alcoholic. I try to show up for the new man, new women, and maybe not so much the women nowadays, but certainly the men who want to get well, who want to do a page 20. What do you have to do? I don't go out there seeking to try and convert, persuade, rescue, save, you know, become the great messiah. If people want to get well, they'll get well regardless of when I'm involved or not. But they'll look for a closed mouth, understanding friend, somebody who's been there, who knows the nature of it, who knows how it works and why it works, then, you know, please count me in, and that's what I do. Absolutely. That's my job. That's my job description, to keep me out of me, because I said at the start of the call, I'm my favourite subject. I love me sometimes, you know, but it's a different form of love. It's self-love. It's self-care. It's having a sense of humour. It's enjoying life and enjoying being around Agnes, my wife, who's tolerated me, who knows my story. She knows about the crossing lines. She knows a bit of a lad, a bit of a rascal. Now she knows that I'm just a boring fella now. And I love being boring. I love just being at home with my book and my writing and hanging with one or two good people and living a low kind of a low profile nowadays. I don't want to be the great I am. I don't want to be at the centre of attention. I just want to be there for the new man, the new woman who's struggling with this disease, because alcoholics are my type, die of alcoholism. And when I rest my laurels, which I'm capable of doing across my line sometimes, I'm very much aware of that. I reach up and reach out, and I do my recovery imperfectly sometimes, and I engage my wife, engage my kids in a way that it's on their terms and conditions, so much so that I don't mind doing the dishes and not getting a pat on the back from it, you know. And I've got a boy who's 6'2", and I'm not quite into you, you know. He's he's a funny guy, but he's got a view and opinion. I don't always agree with it. But having said that, you know, we've never fallen out. My son and I have never had a major fallout. I've never lifted my hands to my son. I've never lifted my hands to my kids when they were young. I've not lifted my hands, apart from one time in self-defense, in 28 years. I've not drank for a long time, but I've had many emotional drunks. I've had many spiritual wrong turns. And I thank God for good guidance. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in a relapse recovery program. Alcoholism in the spirit of recovery, Hank Lawrence, is a toothless paper tiger. You know, and wherever you are in the journey, folks, wherever you are, whoever you are, wherever you are in that mindset, you know, there's a program recovery, there's a treatment plan, and it's not rocket science. 30 pages from 58 to 88 to connect to higher power in order to get the sort of get the juices going and to then go out there and have a life. Go out there and have fun, you know, and just do what I need to do, and that's what I do. If it's not fun, it's no use, you know, and I enjoy laughter, enjoy feeling, but really at the end of the day, I'm very blessed, very fortunate, and I've heard a lot about gratitude tonight. Gratitude for me is, I'm not grateful, I'm willing to sort of go out there and just tell my story to those who want it. Without the idea of trying to control, manage and fix people, I don't want to be the big boss man now or tell anyone what to do. If they want it, they can do it. I believe the higher power. I believe in the fact that people can get well with or without me. I'm just here. I'm just a simple messenger who just shows up as best he can. So thank you, Lawrence, for leading the meeting. Thank you, Wayne, for inviting me. It's an absolute joy to share with you tonight. I wish you all the very best. Stay safe, and you're no longer alone. Thank you very much.